I'm going to stay with UNC right now as well because we've got Max Orr here in the studio for another round of Oh the Humanities, talking about humanities scholarship research and upcoming events, including one coming up next week, Tuesday, February 6th, at Flyleaf Books, which we're going to talk about here in just a second. We got a special guest who, for the second, shall remain nameless, but stay tuned. You'll hear from her in just a second. But first of all, Max, going to be with you again, as always.
Always a pleasure to be with you. You've had a little respite from me for a little while, which is good. Other visitors from Carolina Public Humanities.
Yeah. So, well, it's good to have you. It's good to have you back.
I'm happy to be here. And as
I have to say that because he's sitting right here. Exactly. If I say anything else.
I heard what you said on the air for the last few weeks, but I wanted to bring you, as I always do, things that happened on January 29th. A thing that happened on January 29th in 1886, Carl Benz patented the first successful gas-powered internal combustion engine car, which he called the horseless carriage.
Cool.
And as you know, Carl Benz went on to form in 1926. Several years later, he merged with Daimler to form the Daimler AG company, also known as Mercedes-Benz. Mm-hmm. This is now the second largest car manufacturer in the world. They make cars in 30 different countries and on just about every continent. The company is worth 70.44 billion euros. So it is an example of an incredibly successful international and global business. This is a little depressing to me because I found out that this person is younger than I am. This is also the birthday of Paul Ryan, the 62nd Speaker of the House, a former candidate for Vice President. I don't need to introduce who he is. I think everybody knows who Paul Ryan is, but I would like to focus on one aspect of him, is that he studied economics, especially influenced by Milton Friedman, Hayek, and Ludwig von Mises, as others. He's very much a neoliberal free trader, if you will. And in 2016, he had this quotation, quote, "As Republicans, our challenge is to become a pro-market party and not a pro-business party. Free trade is one of the things that helps us knock down those barriers, which we're having a hard time now within the party."
Mm-hmm.
So he was basically making a comment about what was happening among sort of the populist wing, as demonstrated by Donald Trump, which, Aaron, as promised, has something to do with why I brought our guest with us.
Very cool.
And our guest is Lena Mosley. She's professor of political science, and she is going to be kicking off our Humanities in Action series at Flyleaf Books, a series of talks all the spring on the philosophy, politics, and economics behind our most pressing issues. It's a joint UNC-Duke PPE program. And so what I've done is I've asked people who are involved in the program from both Duke and UNC to give a talk on a particular policy. And Dr. Mosley is here. She's going to be giving a talk called Building Walls and Saving Jobs, Right-Wing Populism and Economic Globalization. So January 29th is a very important date for your topic. And I bet you didn't know that, but welcome, Lena.
Thanks, Max. So I'll just say a few words about this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question mark in the title of my talk about whether or not right-wing populism and the sort of strategy of closing off markets and closing off trade and potentially renegotiating or pulling out of trade agreements is one that will create jobs. And most economists would argue that that's not a way forward in the contemporary world. And yet many voters sort of, you know, seem to accept that message that this is a way to protect their incomes. And so that really gets us into some of the questions around domestic politics about not only whether countries as a whole gain from trade and gain from global production like Mercedes does, and also thinking about how folks might share in those gains. And so there really are some domestic distributional questions that lie at the heart of these global economic trends.
So go back a step, because there's one sort of fundamental concept that's actually really difficult, I think, for a lot of people to understand, which is sort of the concept of populism in general. How do we begin to define that concept, which is such a nebulous phrase that can take on so many different forms?
So I think it's nebulous because it's often used to mean a variety of different things.
Mm-hmm.
But populist parties and populist movements think have in common typically a sort of anti-elite focus, right? So this notion of professional politicians or even professional economists seeing things one way, and we're going to sort of think about the common person and take things a different way. They typically are also sort of very nationalist. So sort of anti-globalist or anti-international institutions, often making claims about preserving sovereignty and autonomy, and so kind of pushing back from things like the North American Free Trade Agreement or the World Trade Organization. Mm-hmm. So some sort of variant there, and also often associated with authoritarian political practices and personalities, but not always.
What is it about populism that sort of makes it coincide with nationalism? Is it just the idea that globalism or globalization is somehow just inescapably elite, or is there something more to it than that?
Well, I think there is also this claim of autonomy, mm-hmm. right? And sort of thinking about ourselves more locally and nationally as opposed to more internationally, and this kind of resentment oftentimes, right, around this global economic elite who might be doing better than we are and who doesn't have our interest at heart.
So what then distinguishes left-wing from right-wing populism?
So there's both,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I would say that the right-wing populism tends to have a more virulent sort of anti-immigrant as well part that's layered on. So it's economic, but also sort of can have a very nationalist or racist component to it.
Does that also sort of suggest a particular definition of nationalism? I know I had, who was it that was in last week?
Yeah,
week
Lloyd Kramer.
Lloyd Kramer, who is here talking about sort of different conceptions of nationalism. Does that factor into left versus right-wing populism, or... It's probably not just a one-to-one comparison.
Yeah, I mean, I would say you can slice that sort of in these different
ways.
There
are Venn diagrams for this, right?
Yeah.
Someone
right.
is, you know...
Everything breaks down and just becomes very hard to categorize as soon as you start looking at it really
well,
closely.
I think one of the things that's interesting about what you're saying about the people and this distaste for the elites is that it also has to do with when you see economic change and you see the elites are those that are engaged in this cosmopolitan act of exchange of currencies across borders and dealing with places that many of the people who are in populist politics have never been to or imagined going to. And so there's a sense of, well, they're stepping outside of the national framework and they're getting wealthy from that and we're the true people. And so we're, you know, this is, I think, also adds into that sense of resentment in populist movements.
Right. And indeed, there's a great book that came out recently by a woman named Kathy Kerrimer Walsh at the University of Wisconsin called The Politics of Resentment. Right. And she's really looking at within Wisconsin this sort of, you know, the folks in traditional manufacturing areas versus those in Madison and sort of this sense of those people don't understand us here. And I do think there is something to this materially in terms of the distribution of gains.
Sure.
Right. So we know that global poverty rates have gone down over time, right? We know that, you know, the sort of median U.S. consumer is able to consume a lot of things that we couldn't have dreamed of consuming, right, at the median income level a couple of generations ago. And yet, there's a sense of the gap between the median person, right, and that top 1% has grown. I mean, we know it has grown over time.
Yeah.
And so I think that also feeds into this resentment.
Well, you see these memes right across Facebook about just telling us how much things cost in the 70s compared to how much they cost now and how much salaries for CEOs have gone up. And where that hits and where that resonates could hit right wing, could hit left wing, but you're going to find resentment and the growth of a populist movement potentially out of these types of feeling of left behind, right?
And what's interesting, I think, is that we have political leaders, going back to our populist movements, who can be quite strategic in terms of using these policies or these feelings of resentment to then point to the global economy as the source.
Mm-hmm.
Because one could say, well, if we've got rising income inequality in places, that is, a lot of that is to do with domestic policies, right? We can talk about tax policy, for instance, right? We could talk about income redistribution more generally. And we know that some countries have had greater increases in that gap than others, right? So you could say, well, that's all domestic.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could say, you're unhappy. It's not our problem. It's the fault of that group over there or that organization
out there.
We're
speaking with Lana Mosley, again, UNC political science professor. She's going to be giving the talk next week, Tuesday, February 6th at Flyleaf Books. The talk is called Building Walls and Saving Jobs, Right-Wing Populism and Economic Globalization. Humanities.unc.edu is the website for Carolina Public Humanities. You can go there and get more information about the talk, including how to sign up and register for it, also a whole calendar of events for upcoming events as well. So one question question that's fascinating me is, why does right-wing populism really catch on now? You can sort of go back, only the last 25 years, ever since the collapse of the Iron Curtain and the end of the Cold War and the sort of emergence of the truly global capitalistic economy for the first time. And there have been those sort of right-wing populist moments. You had Ross Perot in 92, Pat Buchanan speaking at the RNC, and he makes his whole career on right-wing populism. You have a bunch of different incidents of or instances or moments when right-wing populism has existed and could have risen to the forefront. You have left-wing populism, too, with the Occupy movement and a couple of other moments. Why does right-wing populism take off now as opposed to 92 or 2001 or 2009?
Well, I think it's great to realize that this is not entirely unique historically. So we could also go back to the 1920s and the 1930s, right? And folks who have tried to sort of count up right-wing populist movements over time and across countries have lots of material with which to work. I think that being said, that we're in this point where we've had a couple of different economic shocks that have combined to make folks feel less secure in many cases. And so you have the Great Recession, of course, right? So this is linking sort of housing markets with people's sense of how well they're doing. We also have big shifts in the nature of the economy and the nature of work. And so most economists would say that much of the job loss or threat of job loss is due to automation and not to trade. But I think in some ways, unless you're an actual Luddite, it's much easier to get angry about the global economy and about trade agreements than it is to get angry about technology, right? And so I think that the combination, and then the third thing, of course, are these rising inequality, stagnant real wages. And so we could tie this into the decline of organized labor unions in many places as well. And so in some ways, it's a bit of a perfect storm for the rise of these sorts of movements.
And one of the things I think is really what you find when you look at all this is that there you can criticize the sort of economic consensus that predates or that is the trigger for all of this. And there's lots to complain about. You know, where corporate responsibility? Are they responsible to a nation? Are they responsible just to their shareholders? You know, where are the jobs? And, you know, is there a responsibility to more than just shareholders and to our employees? So there's a lot to critique of a system of this economic globalization. And but I think the populist idea is to present a simple idea, present a simple solution, that if we could just, as you mentioned right in your opening, if we could just stop this one thing, we could get back, you know, it's the classic, well, you know the expression, you know, it's make whatever great again, get back to the way it was. And I think that's also part of populism, is an easy fix, right? That there is an easy fix, and that's why it does veer towards authoritarianism. I'd love your feedback on that, if that's at all accurate, but it just seems that way to me. The easy fix leads to authoritarianism.
Yeah, and I think we shouldn't ignore the role of leaders and elites who are sort of pushing these views as well, right? Mm-hmm. So we know that many individuals will follow sort of partisan cues, and so they see partisan leaders saying certain things, they come to believe them. And so there's a big gap, for instance, in how self-identified Republicans versus Democrats think about the contribution of trade versus automation to economic distress. Mm-hmm. And so Republicans are much more likely to blame trade. Democrats are sort of in the middle of part automation, part trade. And that's interesting because it's following elite cues. It's also interesting because as those elite messages change, we often see that voters will follow, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a, you know, this kind of phrase political scientists like to use is party ID is a really strong drug, right? One's partisan leanings are often fundamental. And so if party leadership moves its views, we also see the public move.
Yeah, and partisan leadership is really changing pretty rapidly because you started by talking about Paul Ryan, who's talking about the importance of the market in 2016, and now he's trying to sing the same song, but he can't because of circumstances.
Yeah. So, I think that shows you that populism's destabilizing effect, right? It's destabilizing their own sort of elite allies, if you will, because these are the people that are going to pull this populist, you know, ideology into fruition. But the people like Paul Ryan, they're not on board. They're, you know, I don't know what his position is on free trade now, but I can't imagine it would be too different than it was in 2016.
So what, and we're speaking with, again, Lena Mosley, who's a UNC political science professor, going to be speaking on Tuesday, February 6th at Flyleaf Books, Building Walls and Saving Jobs, Right-Wing Populism and Economic Globalization. Humanities.unc.edu is Carolina Public Humanities website where you can go and get more information about that event. then, including how to sign up and register. A lot of other events on the calendar as well, but this is one that I'm really excited about as well. So how do these movements, I mean, populism has this sort of ebb and flow, as you mentioned, over the course of American and world history. We're seeing the flow. What causes the ebb? Or did I just get that right? What causes the recession of, yeah.
Right. So
I'm not good at title lingo, but yeah.
Right. So I think in many ways we are at an interesting point in our history, mm-hmm. In that we've got most countries in the world taking part in the global trade and production system. So that means a lot more competition from places like China, but mm-hmm. many others as well. We also have this kind of technological change around automation that's leading to some job loss. And we do have pretty remarkable levels of income, but especially wealth inequality in many countries, including the U.S. I'm not sure sort of what leads that all to turn around, right? We often will see, you know, sort of big adjustments in social policies, right? Can sort of, if we think about the U.S. in the 1930s, right? And sort of the rise of the modern welfare state. But it's perhaps hard to imagine something like that coming back, at least given the current political constellation.
Well, there are a lot of things that have been hard to imagine politically in the last few years. So I'm sure political scientists have had to temper the what can we imagine? We could hardly imagine.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to add one other thing, because we've touched on so many things, and not to be too promotional about it. But what's so great about what Lena is bringing in and opening up this conversation is that this whole series this spring on the policy matters, that we're going to be touching on these ideas of corporate responsibility. We're going to be touching on ideas of, you know, can we have a market economy and equality? What about a universal basic income? And are these the types of solutions that temper populism, that temper, you give the people a little bit of sucker, you allow them to feel like they're not living a precarious life, mm-hmm. And then perhaps the benefits of the economy will become more apparent to them. Well, who knows, right?
Humanities.unc.edu is the website for more information about Carolina Public Humanities and about this talk next week, Tuesday, February 6th, 4:30 to 6 p.m. At Flyleaf Books. Anything else that people want to know about this event or the upcoming series?
Well, I would like to mention, if people would like to come tonight to The Ties That Bind, it's at Silver Spot Theater tonight. It's a wonderful talk. I know you had Rachel Shavitz coming in and discussing that. I would just suggest to people that if they would like to come, faculty, staff, and students can come to any of these Flyleaf Books talks for free. Each of them are sold ticketed individually, but we do have a very good deal if you'd like to get the whole series at a much reduced price. And it's great learning on Tuesday afternoons all spring. And we'll probably have a few more guests from that particular program here, Aaron.
Yeah, definitely. If you've got the evening free, don't miss the screening of that documentary at Flyleaf tonight. And sign up for the Building Walls and Saving Jobs talk next week, Tuesday, 4:30 to 6. At Flyleaf Books, not to be missed. Max Orr, Lena Mosley, thank you so much for being here today.
Great. Thanks so much, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron.